You're listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avasant on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer-in-residence. From March 12th to 15th in Washington, D.C., the Satellite 2018 conference and its TED Talk-like SGX events will give a landscape view of the market-shaping trends in government and commercial space. To discuss what's on tap at the conference and within the space economy, we're joined by Avasant's Brett Perry, a senior analyst, and Andrew Penn, an associate. Brett, Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, August.
Andrew, let's kick this off and get your view, really the high-level view, about the greatest innovations right now that are coming from this crop of new space companies. And what is the interaction with traditional space players and how they're doing business?
Yeah, it's a great question. Honestly, it's a bit of a loaded question, to tell you the truth, because depending on where in the value chain you look, you know, different innovations are taking place and having different impacts on the market. And so maybe just to focus the question a bit, I'm going to zoom in on the manufacturing side and also broaden the definition of innovation and not just be a technological, but even just approach to doing business. And I think when you look at the manufacturing side and what's happened there, there's a series of different innovations taking place. One is use of COTS components, and others additive manufacturing, vertical integration, mass production, miniaturization. You can name quite a few, and I think the theme that ties them all together is what's been happening among new space players and their end goal, which has been lowering cost to build a satellite and reducing the time to get that satellite in orbit. And all of these really play into that overarching goal. And so the piece that's not directly technologically related that I referenced, that's going to be more on the culture side, which is something that the traditional primes are going to struggle a bit more with and how to adopt that and bring that into their own ecosystem, because culture is slow to change. And the traditional primes, when you kind of look at their genesis and how they became to be who they are today as companies, it goes back all the way to Apollo through the Ultimate Challenger and Columbia disasters. And there's been a lot of risk aversion that's cropped up in those organizations over time. And that's generated a lot of slow processes and red tape, which ultimately slows them down and adds cost. Those two issues that these new space companies are trying to overcome. So when you think about ways that some of the traditional primes can incorporate in these aspects and react to what the new space firms have done, they can't really address that culture one in any short attempt or quick ability. So what they've tried to do is cherry pick some of those more direct cost approaches, whether it be additive manufacturing, moving a little bit more into the vertically integrated manufacturing processes, and bringing in some COTS components as well. But the other challenge that they've faced is these different innovations work with a bit of a chain link logic. And what I mean by that is, you know, each one can provide a certain benefit in their own right, but it's only when you take them all together that you can see the real evolutionary leaps that you're seeing in the new space companies. And so I think at the end of the day, the traditional primes are doing the best thing they can, which is cherry pick some of these where they can to get some incremental benefit. But what's been most effective for them so far is placing bets with some of these new space companies directly and trying to reap the fruit of their labor on their own.
You know, Brett, one of the really interesting facets of the new space movement is the financing side of it, because this is a very capital-intensive business. What is the state of play right now when it comes to funding new orbital networks, new orbital constellations, I should say, launch, other innovations that are really shaping the business?
August, that's a really important question, because when you look at the funding for new space ventures, since 2009, they've received roughly between $12 and $13 billion, depending on how you calculate it. But where are we now, especially now that new space isn't new, because we've seen such significant growth over the past couple of years? I think when you look at the funding for new space companies and what we're going to see, there are two aspects to focus on. The first is the amount of funding that some of these ventures require, and that really revolves around their business model. For instance, some of these startups have ambitious architectures that will require hundreds and if not billions of dollars to fully finance, develop, and field, which can scare away some investors. Others share more characteristics with what we see in the broader startup community, in the sense that they're trying to develop a minimally viable product and then pivot around that. The second key aspect around funding for these new space companies is the sources and where it's coming from. Four to five years ago, much of the funding really came from what we refer to as accelerators that would try to connect with these startups and help them grow into the industry. And then 3 to 4 years ago, and we're seeing it now much more frequently, venture capitalists, especially those that are not focused on space but have investments in other high technology industries, have taken such a huge interest. The next step is, when are we going to see private equity and pension funds show the same type of interest and invest? Many in the industry believe that those communities are critical for securing enough capital to fully support some of these ventures.
One of the really interesting subsections, and where there's obviously a lot of value in the space business right now, is data analysis. Where is this market going? Because there's a lot of change underway to essentially separate the constellations that are being launched and the data that they produce.
August, that's a really important question. And we've seen this trend towards productization of data over the past year and a half. As these new space companies began to field their pathfinders and begin to deploy their constellations and show that the technology behind their concepts was feasible, the next step was, how do we make revenue? What's the business case behind this? What's the business case if you're imaging certain parts of the world every couple of days, or securing or sensing certain characteristics every week? What's the value behind that? And so we've seen over the past year and a half, some of these companies put more attention into how do we quantify this data in a way that we can sell to customers who have frankly not dealt with the space industry at all. For instance, when you look at some of these data analysis companies, their customers range from insurers to hedge fund traders to oil and gas field operators. Folks in communities have historically not leveraged data from space. So we've seen such a significant amount of attention from these operators and from these companies in trying to figure out, how do we deliver value to these communities? How do we leverage the sensing and leverage the terabytes and gigabytes of data that we amass daily and turn it into value that we can sell and close our business case? As a result, you've seen several companies that have been highly successful crop up that are just focusing on that portion. And you're also seeing some of these operators vertically integrate and try to take over the data analysis part themselves, because they realize it is such a critical part of their business case.
Is that vertical integration strategy something that will be around for the long term, or is that more a near-term response to new competition?
I think it's a combination of a near-term response, but in the long term, you're going to see this vertical integration because it's necessary to close the business case in many of these companies.
Yeah, and I'll just add on to what Brett's saying there. When you look at a lot of these new space startups, most of the original ones started on the manufacturing side with innovative ways to build satellites at scale to achieve lower costs and launch faster. And I think what they realized is, once they had their satellites on orbit, there was only so much value they could realize by selling raw imagery. Essentially, they'd be selling it to other operators and value-added service providers who would take that data, apply their algorithms to it to generate real products. And as they started studying the market, they said, we can access so many more verticals and generate so much more upside if only we were touching the end users more. And that's what started that initial wave of vertical integration that Brett was referencing. And what could happen is, you'll see it on the other side, because since then, you have a lot of these newer companies that are purely data shops, focus on the algorithms, who will buy the imagery off of the operators. And what's happening there is, they're still relatively small companies. There's not a lot of scale, and it's more efficient for them to just buy secondhand imagery. But as their algorithms really take root in the customer market and they're able to generate some scale, it could be that they will in turn vertically integrate themselves and realize the value in owning their own constellation, so they don't have to pay the markup on imagery. So I do think the question is spot on, and there certainly could be a continued trend towards vertical integration.
You know, one of the markets that is not thriving right now is the geocoms market. What's holding it back? And is there a turnaround you think that's coming, Andrew?
Well, August, I mean, if that's not the question that's on everybody's mind at satellite, I don't know what is. You know, if you look back at the geocoms market over in the last 10 years, this is probably the single biggest dip since the early 2000s. I think last year, depending on how you count them, there were about maybe 10 geo, or I guess we go back to 2016, there were maybe 12, 13, 14 orders. Last year, around 10. This year, there's only a handful that have been placed so far. And when you talk to folks in the industry, there's just not a sense of optimism around that turning around anytime soon. You know, we work with a host of clients on the manufacturing and operator side, and nobody sees a big turnaround just around the corner. And what we think is the main element driving the slowdown is really, in a word, uncertainty. And there's two aspects of that uncertainty. One is technological uncertainty, and the other is market uncertainty. From the technology side, the last 5 years has probably seen the greatest growth in new approaches to delivering communications from orbit than we've seen in the last 30. When it comes to, it used to be bent pipe satellites were the way to go. You send a signal up, it comes back down. You know, from there, we've moved into processed signals, where you can now send a signal up and route it in the sky back down to multiple points. We've also introduced high throughput satellites, which will really change the economics of delivering communication services from space. And then there are some of the newer technologies, such as flexible payloads, which allow us to rearrange coverage, change power dynamics, and change capacity all on the fly. And so what that has operators doing is saying, you know, how do I maximize my ROI? What is the best approach to minimize my cost per bit? And then just to complicate things more, you have new innovations like on-orbit servicing coming along, which allow operators to now kick the can even further as they debate which technology they want to incorporate into their next satellite. So where in the past, a satellite would reach its 15 to 20-year lifespan, and if you wanted to keep those cash flows going as an operator, you had to have that next satellite up there before you decommissioned the existing one. With on-orbit servicing, they can now hire essentially a space tug for rent attached to their satellite and keep it going for another 5+ years, which just allows them to delay that CapEx until they feel they've got a better handle on the ideal technology investments they want to make into the future. And that's just the technology side. On top of that, you have the market uncertainty. If you look at the original core driver for communication, it's always been the video market. And the video market has been heavily disrupted by over-the-top communication services offerings, such as the Netflix and Amazon Primes of the world. And that's put a lot of downward pressure on price points. So many of the major operators have lamented their pricing point situations, which has caused them to lower their CapEx forecasts and just have them pull back really on their new satellite orders. So to bring it back to the main question, which is really, when is this going to turn around? I think the ultimate answer is we're going to have to wait and see. Wait and see what's going to happen with some of these new LEO constellations. Will they be successful? Will they not be? Will consumers really drive towards over-the-top delivery services where receiving live television is less of a driver for them, and they're very happy consuming innovative content independent of where it's coming from and how? And so it's really a wait-and-see question. What's clear today, though, is the uncertainty is going to continue for at least another few years.
And August, I'm going to add on to that. With these challenging market conditions that Andrew just described for the broader community, so the manufacturers, the subsystem providers, and even the launch providers, when you look at these challenging conditions, it amplifies the importance of having a strong backlog, especially if you're a publicly traded company, because that's what your investors are going to look at. And so for these in these challenging conditions, you're going to see companies think more and more about, if we can't win our backlog, what do we need to grow it, and how do we keep it sustained, especially when you look at the CapEx intensive manufacturing activities required to maintain a persistent presence in this industry. So I think that's another variable that we're going to start to see, that we've been seeing grow in prominence, and will do increasingly so as these market conditions plateau or worsen.
So as executives and investors are dealing with this paralysis of choice, there's still this tipping point, though, coming, right, with small sats, whether they're wafers, but essentially like cheaper satellites than we've ever had access to before. And so like the science fiction fan in me says this can't happen soon enough, but the professional skeptic in me says we're still in the show me phase until this really scales. So how soon until that does become reality and I guess even further disrupts the business?
That's a great question. When you look at the small sats, I think from you have it in two buckets. So the communication sides with these large broadband constellations that Andrew's discussed, and then the remote sensing aspect as well. I think we've seen the remote sensing small sats grow in terms of their impact more quickly than the small sat constellations. And part of this has just been market timing, technology feasibility, and some other factors. The broadband question and the question around, are any of these small sat constellations going to succeed? And if so, who's going to succeed and how many can succeed? Is the market large enough for all of these constellations? Because if you look through the different filings right now, you'll see that there's a dozen. And so from an investor or a competitor perspective, it's challenging because how do you pick your winners? Who do you think is going to be the most successful? Because one could argue that with how the market's structured, not all of these concepts are going to be successful market ventures. So I think that tipping point, it's definitely on the radar, but I think we're going to see the winners in the early to mid 2020s for the broadband small sat constellations. Now, nonetheless, though, even though that seems far out, the critical part to being successful is that first mover's advantage and moving quickly as opposed to being reactive. And that's what we're starting to see a little bit.
The small sat evolution really, to me, underscores also this interrelationship between commercial and military technology in space. And so it seems like there is a lot that military space can learn from the commercial side, but also the reverse is true as well. You know, there's this Air Force Research Lab initiative, for example, to put commercial satellite communications antennas on tactical aircraft like F-16s. You know, there's experimentation happening to help with the really practical challenges of 21st century warfare. Where do you see that back and forth between military and commercial space evolving in the next few years?
Yeah, it's a great question, August. And I think you almost have to back up a little bit and to understand what the interplay has always been between commercial and military, because they've been largely complementary and they've kind of ebbed and flowed from who the technology leader has been over time. You go back to the Apollo era, the first time the U.S. really started putting serious dollars behind space investment, it was all government driven. The commercial industry essentially took guidance from NASA. They provided the design plans and went with it. Likewise, in the Corona days from the NRO pushed the goals down towards commercial, and commercial responded. But what we're seeing today is a bit of a shift through some of the red tape discussion points we mentioned earlier, and this growing risk aversion is cropped up within the military sphere. You know, government procurements have slowed down dramatically, taking anywhere between 7 and 15 years to put new satellites on orbit, while the commercial realm is taking the exact opposite approach, speeding up faster and faster, getting a satellite on orbit within a year of initial design, and in some cases even more sooner than that. And we're now seeing a lot of DoD leadership, and this is outside of just the U.S. government as well. You're seeing global governments as well take the same approach, recognizing that we need to adopt some of these commercial processes. To be more resilient, we need to be able to put assets on orbit faster and replenish them more quickly. And so we expect that trend to continue, and, you know, it's probably not the last shift in the cycle we'll see. I wouldn't be surprised if 10 years from now the cycle shifts again and the military starts innovating in new ways that commercial will ultimately adopt.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And to add to what Andrew said, I think the big element is how. How is the DoD going to leverage some of these non-traditional commercial technologies in its space defense architectures? We've been seeing a significant interest in the use of other transaction authorities through consortiums. So, for instance, SMC has set up its own space enterprise consortium. And then you have DIUX, which are both trying to source space technologies from non-traditional commercial providers. And then, but then within the Air Force, you have the Operationally Responsive Space Office, which was just renamed to the Space Rapid Capabilities Office as a testament to its growing importance in supporting the insertion of these commercial technologies into existing fields. And then you have to also think outside of the traditional DoD community and think of what is NQTEL doing? What is NGA doing? What is the NRO doing? Because all of those organizations have significant presences in Silicon Valley, elsewhere, where these new technologies are spawning. I think the key challenge, though, is going to be, when are we going to see the transition from these prototype technologies into formal concepts? When are the next, you know, when are the Air Forces or the NROs next imaging or next communication satellites going to fully leverage these technologies? Because until then, these commercial applications will only be prototypes that will draw interest, but will not be fully integrated with the Air Force's suite of capabilities. So I think it's something that a lot of people are watching as the Air Force thinks, how is it going to change the way it does its acquisition, particularly for space?
Yeah, in many ways, that ties back to your first question, August, around some of the innovation taking place on the new space side, and how are the traditional primes responding to that? And we talked about, well, there's a bit of a cultural barrier there, and that cultural barrier was really instilled from all of their engagement with the government. And so the government themselves, as much as they are now trying to adopt some of these new space processes, at the end of the day, they are the source for that risk aversion and slow inertial change. And so I think you're going to see the traditional primes and government move in lockstep in that regard as they try and implement some of these new processes. It's going to be a slow process, but hopefully they'll be able to make it happen.
Well, Brett and Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, August.
Thank you.
Make sure to catch Avasant at Satellite 2018 and also SGX. And to listen to more of the On the Record podcast, you can find us on iTunes or at avasant.com.